Greetings, all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 145. And last time we were discussing the fleeing of Lot. He was commanded by the holy angels, the two angels that came to deliver him, because God had mercy on Abraham. And he loved his servant Abraham. And also he had mercy on Lot, because there was still a measure of righteousness in him. As later on we would read in the New Testament, where it is said about Lot, in the book of Hebrews, the Apostle Paul is saying about Lot that he was a just man and he was being vexed daily by the wicked conduct of the people around him. So he was not, in spirit, one of them, but unfortunately his family were not as righteous as he was, and apparently he was the only one. And that was one reason for the utter destruction of the whole area. And so the angels were trying their best to get him out of that place. And he, because of various reasons, and obviously he was not a strong man, he was not a great man of character and faith as Abraham was. When God told Abraham to do something, he rose up early in the morning and did it. No if, yes, and buts. With Lot, we find a lot of that humanity that we find in us. And the reason is, he hasn't reached the point, as Jesus Christ said later on, that he that follows me must forsake everything. He must not that he hates, but he must come to the place where nobody is important to him before God. Not father, not mother, not brother, not any possession that he has. And Lot has not arrived at that point. And of course, obviously, one reason is, when you live in a place where people are righteous, you become more righteous. When you live in a place where people are not, Before you realize it, it gradually wears on you and you become a part of it. And your faith becomes very much eroded and you don't realize how down the drain you're going. And unfortunately, we can sympathize with Lot, because we ourselves find ourselves in this day and age, in this world in which we are, to a degree more like Lot than like Abraham. And so in verse 16, as we read the last three verses, he lingered. They told him to get out of that place, but he lingered. And he had different reasons to do it. And then the men laid hold on him. Finally, were forced to. And had to force him out. And sometimes some of us behave in that manner. You know, literally, we have to either force ourselves to, or kick ourselves, or somebody else has to do it to get us out of the situation that we know better. We shouldn't be there. But he lingered, and the man laid hold on him, upon his hand, that is, literally, they grabbed his hand, and upon the hand of his wife, because all of them were in the same quandary. Their family were, you know, were still around, family members, be it the sons-in-law and their children. You can imagine how difficult it was, humanly speaking. But when we are single-minded, when our eyes are on God, we obey Him and not the surrounding. And so they laid hands upon him and his wife. You know, they held their hands literally like children upon the hand of his two daughters. And the Lord being merciful unto him. You see, this is the explanation behind it. God was still merciful to him, realizing this is, you know, the humanity of Lot, the situation in which he was. That he's not of the same nature of Abraham, character of Abraham. And God knows how much we can take, how much we can withstand. He knows to what degree we can be fully obedient to Him, how much we can give up this world, and to what degree we're still a little bit weak. And so He's compassionate and merciful, yet the time comes when God says, you either do it now or else. And so the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him forth and set him without the city. They literally had to grab them and take them all the way out of the city. Put them on the road and, you know, just tell them, just get out of here. And it came to pass, when they had brought them forth abroad, that is outside of the city, and one of the angels said to them, escape for your life. So here, in essence, you find three commands. First one is escape for your life. Second one is look not behind you. And third one, neither stay you in all the plain. Escape to the mountain, lest you be swept away. In other words, these are three commands that they gave him. If he transgresses any one of them, the consequence will be destruction. And so they warned him of that. And later on we read a similar warning by God himself, the one that sent them to Sodom and Gomorrah when he came in the flesh, and when he spoke to his disciples about the end time, a time where it's not going to be a total devastation like with Sodom and Gomorrah, but there is going to be an awful lot of it, and especially in specific about Judea, when the armies of Rome start marching on that city and God gives the city into their hands and the area, there will be no time of mercy. So they better flee, he told them. And that's what you can read that in Matthew 24 and verse 16 to 18, where Christ told his disciples a similar situation, war and bloodshed and destruction and all these evil things that are coming, and not only on a local basis, but here he's speaking about the ultimate, and so this is directly speaking to us. So as the two angels were speaking to Lot and his family, this is our God and Creator, our Savior, Jesus Christ, was speaking directly to us, as well as He did to those at that time in His generation, and those that were obviously going to be there in 70 AD, at the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem and the area. That is partial destruction anyway. And so in verse 16, He said, Matthew 24, "Then let those who are in Judea," well, Lot was in Sodom and Gomorrah, and now He's talking about those who are in Judea, "flee to the mountains." Just like they told Lot, "You flee to the mountains," because there were more, you know, there was safety there. And it's away from the city, away from this whole territory that was on a plain. And he said that, you know, they told him to go to the mountains. Verse 17, he said, "Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house." What is it that he's going to take? Physical things. Things that attach him to this world. Things that make very clear to God what is important, what is foremost on the mind of this person. Is it a command? Is it obedience, total obedience? And in faith, knowing that God will provide, He's going to take care of you. You know, just like He took Israel into the wilderness, He took care of them, He fed them. He gave them drink, He gave them food, He gave them manna, He gave them the quail. So He's big enough to support them. And here, you basically are dealing with a matter of faith. People's heart is not on God. Their mind is not on God. All their needs are not placed on God. That is when we cannot do it on our own. We know that God will do it for us. And so when He commands us to be in a situation like that, obviously He's going to provide for us one way or the other. And so it's a matter of faith here. It's a matter of obedience. It's a matter of showing to God, you know, where our heart is. And that's why it says, "You flee to the mountains, flee to the desert, flee," you know, in other words, "flee away from this area. And don't think about anything else, because I'll take care of you." So let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. Now what does it mean on the housetop? You see, you have to understand the time. Houses were near each other, and he could literally walk from house to house. So wherever you are, just flee. That's the point. Just flee. Don't think about anything else. And if he's going to go down, obviously, it's to take something, and that's going to hinder his flight. And to begin with, his heart is not on God, and he's not on obedience, wholehearted obedience. And so verse 13, it says, "And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes." And for that matter, anything else. And so, God is testing us in times like that. Would you fully, wholeheartedly, totally trust in me? Would you be spiritually minded or physically minded? You see? And as we look to others to give us support and comfort and all that, those become our idols. And that's why He said in another place, and you can see it and read it in, I believe, in Luke chapter 6, verse 9, where He says that those who put their hand on the plow and then look back, they're not worthy of me. And that, unfortunately, was the state of mind of Lot, and so much more so of his own family members, especially here, of Lot, Lot's wife, that is. And she's the one that paid the greatest penalty here. And so this is what they told him. Three commands, and he started going to all the mountains. his wife did not obey, and the consequences were soon after there. And so verse 18, and Lot said unto them, oh, not so, my Lord. Instead of total obedience, he's trying to alter the decree for his own benefit, for his own faithlessness and on materialism that was still deeply inside him. And we can sympathize, you know, very much with that. And therefore, we should also take warning. If we have these tendencies, which we do, we're not of the character of Abraham, maybe this is a time to begin examining ourselves and striving in that direction and see how we fare on a daily basis. And so Lot said to them, oh, not so, my Lord. Behold, now your servant has found grace in your sight, and you have magnified your mercy, which you have shown unto me in saving my life, and I cannot escape to the mountain, lest the evil overtake me, which doesn't make sense. What do you mean you cannot escape to the mountain? If they are there to deliver you, and God is with you, why can't you escape to the mountains? Why would any evil overtake you? You see, he's not thinking straight. And so he said, lest the evil overtake me and I die. Behold, now the city is near to me, that is near to flee unto. You know, there was a tiny little town there. And, you know, let me just flee over there instead of going to the mountains. Because in the mountains, there is nothing there. But in the city, at least, you know, there will be some people or food or whatever it may be in shelter. Verse 20, behold, now this city is near unto me to flee unto me, and it is a little one. Oh, let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And oftentimes we think that way. Well, a little sin is not that bad, you know. A big one, okay, I understand. But a little one, you know, why can't you let me get away with a little sin? And it does not work like that with God. We have to totally, as we have to totally love God with all of our being and heart and everything that is in us, we have to totally be willing in our heart and our mind to forsake everything. Our family, you know, possessions, anything that we have in this life, including our own life. And not everybody is capable of giving the ultimate sacrifice. And yet this is what God demands ultimately from all of us. One way or the other, we're going to have to do it. And he knows at the same time how much we can take. He knows how much we can be tempted with before we crack. So he's going to be merciful to us also and help us along the way. And this is where this is where Lot is now. That's his state of mind. And so he said, is it not a little one and my soul shall live? You mean otherwise it cannot? If God tells you to go to the mountains, you mean he's not going to support you and strengthen you and preserve you and protect you? Obviously he will. So what is he talking about here? And he said unto him, see, I have accepted you concerning this thing also. Now they knew that God was going to destroy this whole area too. You see? But, okay, they were willing to compromise. And ultimately, they knew what would the end result be. He's going to have to flee from that place too. And so he said unto him, see, I have accepted you concerning this thing also, that I will not overthrow the city which you have spoken, the little one. It's just like God was willing to compromise with Abraham when he says, okay, if there are 50 there, I'm going to compromise. I'm not going to bring any destruction on the whole area. And you're there 40 or 30 or even 10. Well, that shows the grace of God. That's what the grace of God is all about. And verse 22, hasten thou, escape there, for I cannot do anything till you come there. So here it is, God was going to wait on Lot until he gets to the place of his safety. Therefore, the name of the city was called Tsoar, which means young in Hebrew, or could also mean little. And the sun, verse 23, was risen upon the earth when Lot came unto Tsoar, or Zoar in English. Then the Lord caused rain. Now that was not rain in terms of water. It was a different kind of rain. Then the Lord caused rain upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah, brimstone and fire. That's the kind of rain that came upon them, brimstone and fire. And that was hell on earth when it came. That's a real hell. You know, that's a Gehenna fire that God talks about. A lot of people, you know, because of the false doctrine of heaven and hell, they totally spiritualized the real and made it the ethereal, the non-real, hellfire. Where you go on living forever and ever, you have an immortal soul and you're alive forever and eternity and you're suffering and you're burning, but you're not burning. You know, which doesn't make sense. Then the Lord, in verse 24, caused to rain upon Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. Now this is where it came from, out of heaven. What does it mean, out of heaven? You know, all the way from His throne? Well, that's His power, His glory, and His majesty. And He used it at this time for destruction and not for construction. And it came out of the sky, in essence, out of the blue, so to speak. Verse 25, and He overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. So it was a total decimation. Everybody, everything paid the penalty for the wickedness of that area. As some would say, you know, total sin brings total destruction. And so He overthrew this whole area, and obviously that was a good warning for Lot. You cannot stick around. And so they had to wait until it leaves totally the whole area before bringing it to total destruction on everything. Verse 26, the problem. But His wife looked back from behind Him, and she became a pillar of salt. Now, it was not just, you know, turning the head and looking back there. It's just a matter of curiosity. Was obviously more than that. She may have been overtaken, you know, given to emotions. And she may have been overtaken by the trauma of the whole experience and the fact that her children are there, you know. She still had more daughters there, and they had grandchildren, you know. You were attached to them all these years. And she got to the point where her mind was not at all on what God said. Obviously, she didn't have the faith that Lot had. And even to begin with, Lot didn't have the faith that Abraham had. And so she was given to that. And you can imagine what was going on during the time. They could have been even arguing about it. And she was trying to go back. And he would try, you know, to encourage her to keep forward. And finally, probably she just bolted out and she was on her way back. Not thinking at all. So it's more than just looking back. And so when Christ said, you know, he that puts his hands on the plow and looks back, he's not just talking about looking. You see, he's talking about real action. Going back to the proverb, the dog that went back to his own vomit. And that's in essence what he's talking about. So in essence, just a metaphor, looking back for the real thing. She really intended to go back there and she was on her way. Regardless of all the pleading, you know, of her husband, Lot, and probably even her own daughters. So she did, the daughters did not. They had a little bit more faith in that sense. All fear, interpretation of what was coming. And she was just overtaken by her own emotions, and she couldn't see anything else but what was left behind. And she became a pillar of salt. At what point was it? As soon as she turned around, or was it when she reached the area where the fire and brimstone and all that was falling? You know, did she keep going in that direction until that happened? We don't know. Obviously, we are not given details. There's some speculations here. As some say in the commentary, she looked back and lingered behind to be overtaken by the brimstone and fire, you know, that was rapidly spreading all over the place. From which the others escaped. And a similar fate befell lingering refugees in Pompeii. They give an example of that, you know, when the volcano erupted. Those who just lingered behind because they wanted to grab as much as they could out of their homes, or, you know, fetch their children, whatever, or mates or friends, and they were pulverized in that sense. And so her body became encrusted and saturated with the nitrous and saline substance that very likely preserved it for some time from decay. Well, this is a commentator that says that, De Sola. And then ancient writers refer to this pillar as being still in existence. And Josephus, that's 2,000 years ago, which means you're talking about quite a long time from that event. That's from the days of Abraham. About 2,000 years. And Josephus, 2,000 years down the road, claims that he saw that pillar. And I remember when I was there, when I was a child, there was a place that people were pointing to and that looked like a sort of a pillar there. And people were saying, well, that's Lot's wife. And where, you know, if it is true or not, I don't know. But this is what happened to her. Which in essence, you know, even though it was emotional, it was not intentional, it was not, you know, willful wickedness, or willful disobedience, just a person that is given to his own emotions and feelings instead of obedience to God, you know, in which case he will have faith and strength and peace of mind. And oftentimes, you know, we're all troubled, grievously troubled by whatever problems we have, and we are because we do not have the peace of God. The peace of Jesus Christ said, I'll leave you my peace, not the peace of the world. But that peace cannot come unless we totally put our trust in Him and give ourselves to Him and are saying to Him, here we are at your disposal. Do with us whatever you wish. At that point, you know, He takes care of us. And we get, you know, the feeling at that point, well, somebody else is doing the driving now and it's not me, so I don't have to worry and now we have peace of mind. We know things will turn out all right. So, as we study these things, you know, we should, look at ourselves. How do we function on a daily basis when a little problem or a big problem occurs? And strive harder. Get to the point where we have that peace of mind. And we do when we give ourselves to God and, you know, obey Him and hold on to His hand and never let go. It doesn't happen otherwise. And so we read now about Abraham, verse 27. Obviously, Abraham didn't sleep all night. He knew what was coming. It was a sleepless night for him. And so he got up early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked out toward Sodom and Gomorrah. And he had compassion on them. He had mercy on them, on Lot, on his family, on the rest of the people there that he met many of them as he delivered them earlier in the day of battle. And so he was looking toward there, and his heart was just going for them, but there was nothing he could do. And toward all the land of the plain, and beheld, and lo, the smoke of the land went up as the smoke of a furnace. Everything was burning. And it came to pass when God destroyed the cities of the plain that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow. So the ultimate reason why God delivered Lot was for the righteousness of Abraham. And then later on, God tells his people that when He brings the punishment on them, because he tried many times, He sent many prophets, He sent in essence like many Abrahams to intercede on their behalf, and they would not listen, and they should have known better than the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, who didn't know their right from their left, and had no knowledge of God. They didn't have the Bible, didn't have His Word, didn't have the prophets. You see? So they were not even being warned in that sense by a prophet telling them about the destruction that was coming for a period of months and years, as the people of Israel were. And so he told them, you know, he got to the point that even though righteous men shall stand before me, and he mentioned three personalities, Daniel and Job and Noah. See, Noah delivered the whole earth, so to speak, by the few that came with him. And by doing that, by being righteous men, you know, his family was delivered, which means humanity kept going on. And Daniel was interceding, you know, on behalf of his people, on behalf of his friends. And at one time he delivered even all the wicked, soothsayers when the king wanted to destroy all of them. But the mere fact that he was able to provide the answer, you know, with the help of God, all of them were delivered from total destruction. So God is using personalities that brought deliverance on other people, but He said, had they been here, alive, standing before me, even they would not be able to deliver you, but only their own soul. So the time comes when nobody can intercede on our behalf, and Abraham too, he tried all he could, and because of their wickedness, because there was none that sought God, with the exception of Lot, and even he was a little bit on the weak side, God had to bring out a destruction on them. And so he remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot dwelt. And Lot went up, in verse 30, out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountains. Now, why didn't he continue, you know, further and go all the way to his uncle, Abraham? Well, we don't know. After all, it wasn't that far. But I guess God was not interested in him going back and because he wanted that separation. Whichever is the case, he and his daughters went with him, for he feared to dwell in Zoar, because he was afraid that the destruction will come upon it, and it certainly did after that. And he dwelt in the cave, and he and his two daughters. And the firstborn said unto the younger, Our father is old, and there is not a man in the earth to come in unto us after the manner of all the earth. Now, either they felt that that was a universal destruction that came upon the whole earth, or coupled with the morality that they grew up with in Sodom and Gomorrah, they thought, well, that's the best solution under the circumstances in this area. But another case, you know, when you witness total destruction all around you, you know, who knows how, you know, how would you think? So we cannot, in essence, totally judge these two daughters of Lot for their actions. It's easy to say it when you are not in their condition. And whichever is the case, you know, they did it. After all, remember, those were the days where still a man can marry his sister, or maybe half-sister. And actually, a lot of people were marrying their sisters at the time, so it wasn't that far removed in that sense from the days of Adam and Eve, and many, many, many centuries after that, when people actually married their own kinsmen, you know, very close relatives within the family. And so we have to take all that into account, you know, when we consider this matter, because it's so easy to use our own background and our own morality, our own way of thinking in a totally different era, different circumstances, and then elevate ourselves to the position of the judge of the whole earth and render a judgment. And we shouldn't be doing that. And so the firstborn said unto the younger, Our father is old, and there is not a man in the earth to come in unto us, after the manner of all the earth. In other words, you know, what are we going to do? You know, we're all going to die here, and that's the end of it, you know, and no more offsprings. So you can see their intention was not, you know, their intention was not sexual immorality, you know, they just wanted to have fun. Their intention was reproduction. That was very important. And since nobody's around, what are we going to do? You see, and their father is, is their father, but he's also a man. And that's the only way, you know, the race can go on. So, you know, I have to consider all these matters. And verse 32, come, let us make our father, which is very interesting, because she was not saying, well, one of us got to do it so life can go on. Well, let's the two of us do it, because both of us need to be to continue to have life. I mean, they never were married. They were virgins. Assuming they were. Well, actually, he said that they were, so they were. And yet they wanted both to continue life. So they said, come, let us make our father drunk, that is, drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve seed of our father. And now the question is, where did he get wine? You see, they fled. And, you know, that's not the time when you carry all kind of things with you. Well, as some explain it, that in the old days, people used to harvest the vineyards and then, put the produce in caves to preserve it, you know, either that others would not come and steal it, or just the caves were cool and that was a good place to put it. Especially in an area that is very hot, the caves generally maintain the same kind of temperature day and night, you know, summer and winter. So it would make sense. And we have many other examples later on of people hiding or placing or storing their produce and riches or whatever it may be in caves. So maybe enter into the cave and there it was. There was food there. After all, you know, God was going to take care of him. And what would be a better thing to do but lead him to a cave that has plenty of those necessary things to sustain life. So wine was one of those things. And so that's exactly what they were going to do. And the firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he knew not when they lay down, nor when she arose. In other words, eating and from the food that they found there, and obviously drinking. And they made sure that he drinks more than they do, and get to the point where he's not fully conscious of what is happening. And that's exactly how they did what they did. And so in verse 34, when it came to pass on the morrow, that the firstborn said unto the younger, behold, I lay yesternight with my father. In other words, he didn't realize what was happening. And you can do the same. Let us make him drink wine this night also, and go you in and lie with him, that we may preserve seed of our father. So that was the intent of the whole matter all this time, believing that everybody is dead. And as far as they were concerned, everybody was dead, because God destroyed the whole area. Nobody was left alive, and they were the only ones. And so they were told that they are the only ones too. So what else were they to suppose? And so under the circumstances, you have to realize, you know, why they made the decisions that they did. It's not just because they were children of Sodom and Gomorrah, obviously that had a part in it, but also the tremendous, you know, the sense of survival, the desire to survive as a race, believing everybody is dead, was also a major part of their reasoning. And so they made their father drink, verse 35, wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him, and he knew not when she lay down, nor when she arose. So it was total innocence on his part. And thus were the daughters of Lot with child by their father. And the firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. Moab in Hebrew means from father. And so you can that tells you about the language that they still spoke, even though they lived in Sodom and Gomorrah. Was still the language that is known to this very day is the Hebrew language, Semitic language, and obviously other languages at the time were very similar also. And the same is the father of the Moabites unto this day, and the younger, she also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ami, son of my people. And the same is the father of the children of Ammon unto this day. So when you also consider what is really happening here, in spite of what they did, and you know, just like with Abraham, though he married his half-sister, who was the daughter of his father, but not of his mother, you see, and God withheld a son from him for a long time, they were both barren, yet, here it is, Abraham, who is married to his half-sister, and in today's terms, that's his sister, and even in those days, she was his sister. And she had a son, and Isaac, the father of all of us, the children of Israel, came from that marriage. So here it is, the daughters of Lot, they have children from their father. Now, was God using it because of the circumstances also in that manner, just like he told the children of Adam, you know, you marry your own sisters? Well, obviously we have to begin to think from a greater point of view, you know, a different point of view than our own. Our own narrow-minded, you know, approach and comprehension of whatever we see. God promised that whole area, as he said later on to Moses, I gave that land to Moab and to Ammon. And how is he going to give it to Moab and Ammon if everybody's dead and destroyed and they have no children? You see? So God works out through circumstances, even though they may not be the ideal circumstances that they should be. He did the same also later on with Judah. And Judah had a wife and he had children and, you know, the problem that they had. And God killed the first two. And the third one, he was still young. And the wife that married the first one had married then the second one to bear a child, as was the manner, the custom at the time. And she did not. And so she went away to her parents, and Judah told her, you stick around there until my son is old enough and you can marry him. Well, it didn't happen that way. And so she realized the child grew up and Judah didn't keep his word. So she was about to trap her own father-in-law, and she did. And she had a child from him, actually twins. And from these two came the Jewish race, the people of Judah. So you see that God is working at times even with circumstances that are not necessarily the most ideal. And so we have to consider the whole matter and begin to think from the point of view of God beyond our narrow concepts of matters, whatever they may be. And so the younger called her son Ben Ammi, the son of my people, because he came from her own. You see, she couldn't use the same terminology of the first one, her sister's, Moab, from my father. She couldn't give him the same name, so she called him from my people, because her father obviously was also in that category. And so the same is the father of the children of Ammon unto this day. And chapter 20, verse 1, and Abraham journeyed from thence. So he took off from that place, away, whatever the reasons were, maybe too much grief, witnessing what he did, we don't know. Or maybe God inspired him, just get out of this area and go to another place. And Abraham journeyed from thence toward the land of the south and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur, so he's getting closer to the Sinai desert. And he sojourned in Gerar, and now Gerar was closer to the Philistine territory, today the Gaza Strip. And Abraham said of Sarah his wife, now he's getting closer to heavily populated area. And when he does, and when we do get closer to people, obviously we're going to have to deal with those people. And so Abraham now worries about something he didn't have to, as long as he was further toward an area where people were more decent, because he was staying with the people of Mamre, who were more decent people. They were his allies. But now he gets to people that were known to be war-making people, and so he wasn't sure what's going to happen to his wife, and this is what Abraham is doing. And it's also revealing to us a bit of information we didn't know before that. And we read in verse 2, and Abraham said of Sarah his wife, now she's his wife, he said, she is my sister. So when he walked around and the Philistines saw him and he realized what kind of morality, what kind of people they are, and the violence that was in those people also, he thought, well, that's a good idea to do it this way, because after all, in reality, she was his sister. So it was safer to be that way and not to be a target of someone who is going to take advantage of the situation, and in order to marry him, he would kill him first. So, in essence, he wanted to preserve his life. And then again, you know, he too was showing some measure of humanity. You know, a little bit like his son or his nephew, Lot. Not relying totally on God to protect him from whatever. And so, Abraham said, she's my wife. You know, wherever people ask him, who is she? If you know, you realize that they are not too distant of people, he said, well, she's my sister. And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Well, that was a consequence. And obviously, God was there going to teach Abraham a lesson. He used that situation also for that purpose. God is merciful with all of us, and even the most righteous among us, we still need to learn some lessons here and then. And so we read, this is what Abimelech did, but, verse 3, but God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, behold, you shall die. In other words, you're good as dead. Even though Abraham, you know, didn't tell him the truth, still he was not about to let Sarah be defiled by Abimelech, because Sarah was going to be the mother of the faithful, of the child of promise. And so God had a stake there, so to speak, in protecting her. So he came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, behold, you shall die, because the woman that you have taken for you is a man's wife. You see, even those people understood the law, because, you know, the law of God in measure was all around the earth, even though they did not have a full knowledge and understanding of it. And they knew that when you take someone's wife, you know, the penalty is death. And they generally did not do those things. And that's why they killed people when they wanted to take their wives. And this way she would be free to marry. And so he said, the man, she is a man's wife. Now Abimelech had not come near to her. And he said, and obviously God was also inspiring that or causing that. And he said, Lord, will you slay even the righteous, even a righteous nation? Now what is he talking about, a nation? Well, obviously there was more to it than what is recorded here. the destruction he was going to bring upon him was not only upon him as a man, as a king, but on all of them, everything, everyone. And that's the reason why he makes that. And mind you, he's discussing that matter with God, showing knowledge of the God that he's talking to. So people were not ignorant of the God of Abraham, or of the God of the whole earth. And so this is what he's saying here. Would you slay a righteous nation? That means he knew also a measure of the knowledge of God, of the law of God, and what is right and what is wrong. And he realized, I haven't done anything wrong according to the law, your law. You see? So people were aware of the laws of God to a degree, because as a lot of people are not aware as they should be, in Babylon, which is, you know, a few centuries down the road from Noah, there was still a good measure of the knowledge of God and of the knowledge of the law of God. And the code of Hammurabi, this is where it was. And God is basically bringing the attention to the attention of Abimelech, a law of God that was known by many, many nations at the time, who were still closer to the knowledge of God than later on. And of course, some of them had more than others. The Philistines at the time were more aware of these laws and more obedient, obviously, and the people of Sodom and Gomorrah just went way down the drain. And when God brings this law to his attention, the law of marriage and the prohibition to take somebody's wife, he's basically saying in verse 3, when he tells him, this time, you know, you're going to be dead because of what you have done, he uses a terminology that is very interesting, because this is the first time that you see this terminology used in the Bible, and God is the one using it in this manner. And he said to Abimelech in the dream by night, behold, you shall die because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife. Well, in English, that's what you read, a man's wife. In Hebrew, the terminology that he used was, she is Beulat Baal. In other words, we all heard the name Baal. That's what it means. Baal means owner or master. And so Beulat Baal, that means she's owned by a master, owned by an owner. And especially in the past, they don't do it anymore, though some societies still do. When a man needs to, when he wants to get married, he goes to the father and he gives her, he gives the father a certain amount of money. Dowry, they called it later on. And basically it is, in essence, to compensate the man for losing an employee. Because the daughter, until that time, in agrarian societies, were also one of the workers. And so the father invested in her, and he's going to lose an employee, which means he's going to have to buy another one now to take care of the job that she used to do, his daughter. And so, at that point, the husband became the owner. Sort of, you know, buying and selling, but it's not in the slavery sense. And actually, the word Baal, or, you know, derivation of that, Baale, means masters of, appears the first time in Genesis 14 and verse 13, where there we read that Abraham had friends that were confederate with him, the children of Mamre and his brothers, that is Mamre and his brothers, and he used them to go and fight the kings of Assyria and Babylon when they took Lot into captivity and all the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so there they use the word confederate, which is the first time that this word appears, Baale, Brit, which means owners of the covenant. And owners of the covenant, that means, you know, they were in a covenant with him. And, you know, the Hebrew terminology is different than what became later on. And so to this very day, when you have an owner, when you speak about an owner of a company or an owner of a house or an owner of anything, you call him Baal, Bait, and to the woman, Baalat, in the feminine, Bait, you know, the owner or the master of the house. And this name also became applicable to the false god, which people call the master. And later on in English, you know, you see the word Lord. And it's very interesting, because for many, many centuries, the children of Israel, you know, they worshipped Baal. That is when they came to the land of Canaan after the captivity in Egypt. And there they were worshipping Baal, you know, the owner, the master. In other words, I was a substitute for the God of heaven. So they were worshipping, you know, the deity of the place, which people, you know, as time went by, forgot about the real God of heaven and earth, and they used Baal as the real God. And so the children of Israel thought, well, what's the difference? You know, they're all the gods of the heaven and the earth, and so we worship him. And you see why it was easier for the false prophets to lead them in that direction, to mislead people who have known the God that brought them out of Egypt, and to make them believe that this is the same God. Baal is the same God. You know, Baal means the owner, means the Lord. And God takes an issue with that and talks about the people, you know. As you read in his own words, why do you call me Lord, Lord? You see, and you do not do what I say. And Lord and Baal are the same word, master, owner. And God is addressing this issue in the prophets also about the time that will come when people are not going to use this terminology anymore because of the connotation. In other words, people who believe or have been taught or have been misled by, you know, false prophets to believe that Jesus is Lord, and yet they preach to them, that is, and speak to them of a false Jesus. Well, anyway, we're going to stop at this point and continue next time. This is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people.